Session number 11736, Stephen Pete, Reel 8.
Stephen Pete, Reel 8.
Yeah, the communication was all, I think, fairly well organised by International Red Cross. Unlike anything for Russian prisoners. I mean, that's a whole other story. The things that they didn't have because of not signing a Geneva Convention. But when we were first taken prisoner, quite early on, I don't know where the pieces of paper would have come from, a form you could fill in for a maximum of whatever it was, 15 words. You know, I am well, I'm safe, and happy Christmas. That went as a telegram through International Red Cross, and then there was an issue of a special letter. Once you had an address of a prison camp number, you were allocated, I think it was one letter and one postcard, which were all censored naturally. You had to write in pencil. Wonder why you had to. Anyway, or perhaps we did write in pencil because we didn't have any ink, I'm not sure. We did have ink, yes, because I remember these special letters that I smuggled with people on repatriation. I wrote them in ink. So we must have had ink, but we had to use pencil for these other things. They went, I don't know, they took a variation of 6 weeks, 3 months, in both directions, and occasional parcels came through. Most of the first third of every letter is, you know, I have received letter number so-and-so. And I haven't received letter number 17, but no doubt it'll come soon, and that kind of thing. So that was all right. There was just a long wait at the beginnings on both sides, months wondering where, from this end, from the English end, wondering where I got to, I suppose, which must have been a worrying time.
Well, was it important for you as well to have mail?
Oh, yeah.
With home and other people.
Yeah, it was very great importance to feel you were in contact. Because, and also you didn't know the future at all. At least I don't remember having any huge optimism about the future. People who had optimism about the future seemed to be the ones who were able to start taking courses and preparing for the future. I didn't start doing that myself. Partly, I don't know, laziness or no, lack of optimism about the future. I really didn't know what was going to happen.
Also, I suppose, you know, your particular interest, which would be film, am I right in thinking there would have been no opportunity at all for photography and film?
Oh, absolutely none,
you know,
yeah.
It would have been forbidden, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Writing or...
Well, here's, that's a card in I am showing it, forgetting that this is sound and not picture. This is a card written in pencil. Actually, this is March, very, very close to the end of the war. In the pile, I've got the pile of all the letters, only two that had bits censored out, and I've no idea what. But I'll read you a bit of this because, I'll tell you what. I put this light on, I think.
Yeah, sure, okay.
Yeah, I can see a bit better now. Now, this would be a time when there were really hundreds and hundreds of other prisoners in the camp, as well as being a hospital. It was the end of the war, and in the camp where a great many people had been force marched or rapidly marched with little food and with blisters and with illness and had come in and were in the wards, as well as others who were well enough who were just milling about. So we were looking after them in bed and also organising bits of camp concerts and all sorts of things for the hundreds who were in there. And either we actually could hear the Russian guns or rather guns and German guns in the east, or they were pretty close at this point. And incidentally, I don't know actual figures, but it felt to me like 10 to 1 ratio, possibly it was more like 3 to 1 ratio, of sick Americans compared with British, who had had the same experiences of being marched through. Great many Americans had collapsed, had become lousy, you know, really thick with lice, due to a different kind of background, of a much more protected background. This is a real generalization, and a lot of the English, from their stories, who had managed to rummage around in the fields and get raw carrots and things to eat, or Swedes or whatever, on the march, and had managed to exist and not get ill, compared with the numbers of American young soldiers who'd just given up. It was quite extraordinary difference in the numbers, but that's by the by. Now, where were we? So amongst all this, we gave a variety concert last night. At least one third of the camp staff were in the cast, and the other two thirds comprised the audience. Oh, well, this sounds as though before big crowds have arrived. It went off quite successfully, but there seems something somehow all wrong to be producing farces in the middle of all this. This is all the turmoil at the end of the war. And the letter goes on. So you see what I mean by unsatisfactory and dissatisfied. It's difficult to find the right word. But there's no word strong enough to condemn the frightfulness of the recent raids. This is my memory of what we'd realised by then was Dresden. Surely the war is appalling enough without going to those extremes. The only thing to hope for is that it doesn't go on a minute longer than necessary. So these were my... I found this letter the other day, which reaffirmed my memory of my real strong feelings that were welling up at that time. And didn't care what I wrote in the letter. It's not likely to be censored, that kind of thing, because it doesn't mention anywhere. It's just feelings.
Yes. Were you more aware, you know, we were talking about this much earlier, weren't we, about the strength of your pacifism, and you were saying how Dresden brought the war, your hatred of war, home to you much more, this indicates.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Mm.
Indeed. And also, other things, which I'll come to in a minute. I was out walking on some mock errand with the same Dr. Uli, just about that time, I suppose, a week or two later, when in the small road past the camp, some German military staff cars rushed through at great speed. It was quite a small road with some shouting going on. And he said, you know, they're retreating fast. It means the Russians are close. And it was at that point they arranged to come into the camp, I think. And then the Russians did arrive on bicycles, most of them. And it was just kind of contingent on the edge of some other big... Well, they were advancing very fast towards Torgau, although we knew nothing of where they were. I didn't even know the geography around that place. And they came in and the gates were opened and the German guards disappeared. A dentist who had a house right at the gate of the camp and where I'd been for tooth treatment once or twice, we heard, had, I think, 3 or 4 children. He poisoned his wife and children and then killed himself rather than because of the Russians coming. And the anti-Russian propaganda was so enormous in the papers that the people like him were scared stiff even to meet them alive, as it were. Remember, that was a shocking thing to hear. And then there were all these hundreds of people in the camp and the gates were open and people went a little bit wild, but not very. mean, some people just wandered off, or there were strong instructions not to. And the war was going on just down the road somewhere, as it happened. I didn't know it for weeks or quite a while, because there was no power, no communications, no radio or anything. It was, as I said, about, I think, 15, 20 miles away from Torgau, and that's where the Russians met up with the Americans, maybe a day or two after that, but we didn't know about it. The gates were open, and we flooded out and walked around the town and generally and came back again. A bit worrying going out of those gates. Didn't feel safe. And there was a village green nearby, and somebody suggested a football match, international football match, France versus England, that's right. So there must have been a lot of French prisoners. So this was organised by somebody or other, and they said, we must have a referee. Now, one of the camp guards, I'm not sure whether he had one arm or some way wounded or disabled. One of the guards had been frequently on guard walking around the camp and we knew he lived in the village, had disappeared by then, was known to several people in the camp as being an American footballer who'd played in goal, I think I'm right, he certainly played in the German team in England, against England just before the war. And here he was, a camp guard. Who should be the referee? Naturally, the one professional footballer around. So he was sought out. They found him in the village. And this was with the war still going on down the road. English team, you know, just a mock team, and a French team, with a German referee with the whistle, respected by both sides because he's a professional footballer. I thought it was a marvellous thing, and while we were all out there watching this match, must have been marvellous weather because we were mostly just wearing shorts and nothing else, and down the road in one direction there'd be crowds of Poles with horses and carts making their way home with a Polish flag up on top, or other people going the other way, you know, the whole of country was on the move with half-starving people trying to find their way back to their countries. It was extraordinary. But this English referee, I thought, was great. And then most of the people were marched off towards Torgau, which left the staff of the camp and all the many sick there, because we were obliged to stay because we were running a hospital and a Red Cross on the roof, but now became a hospital for anybody. And every day there was a queue outside of German deserters, you know, coming out of the woods all covered in mud and sores. They'd been keeping out of the way. Russian soldiers, women from the village with sick babies, all coming all in a queue to get treatment. And a wonderful feeling of over-friendliness. It was quite extraordinary all round. There were no senior officers or officials anywhere telling you what side you were on or who was supposed to be your enemy. As far as it was concerned, the war was over. And it was a great, great feeling. And this didn't last very long, because soon organisation began. And again, another story that if it was in a novel it would sound contrived. There was a forest fire about 2 miles away, great billowing smoke, and we all went out all nationalities and uniforms against the common enemy. It was great. And to help put the fire out, I seem to remember being on a bicycle at one point. I suppose somebody lent it me, or I found it leaning against a tree. But that really was, you know, almost like too much of a good thing symbolically. And so we got to know various people in the town, and one family of Polish, German-Polish people,
who had moved forward out of the way of the Russians. Oh, I know, they had some relatives in the town and they were waiting. They hoped maybe, there were two sisters and some tiny children, they hoped maybe that one day their husbands would turn up there. They'd agreed to make this village a meeting point if they could all get together again. And then one afternoon, it's all muddled in time. We were there for quite a number of weeks in this kind of no man's land, no man's time almost. End of May, 45, something like that. Odd people turned up on bicycles, two men and two women with strange thick accents purporting to be South Africans with lots of questions. Didn't take to them, sent them on their way. I'm not sure what, there's a lot of suspicion around naturally. No, but then I was out for a walk one evening in this village. And we discovered, or several of us, we discovered an old people's home that had been abandoned, where there were old people from Berlin, I think, or somewhere, and they'd been abandoned by the people that were running the home. So we got into the camp medical supplies, Red Cross supplies. I mean, they were still fairly, I forget who had the key, but they were, there was some very valuable amount of food in there, so it was carefully rationed. But we, I forget who I went to see, maybe the doctor or one of the senior people, and said these people down the road are badly in need of some extra care. So we got some of these medical supplies to these old people in the old people's home. Nobody, you know, there was no objection to this. It was, as I said, falling ever backwards to be friendly and helpful where we could before the boundaries came, the barriers came down that perhaps we didn't think they were going to come down. And then I saw a cart approaching one end of the village slowly with a horse and cart and some people in and led by a man. And they were a terrible sight. Very, very ill men and boys, led by a Belgian who spoke English, so he explained who they were. They were the remains of a working party from a concentration camp. Working concentration camp. I don't know where they'd been working, in the forests or the mines or something. A group who had been rounded up and machine gunned, and these were some of their survivors. And he wasn't in too bad a condition. He'd just got into the camp, just been put in. He was slightly muddled. He said he was a Belgian espionage man who had been dropped by parachute there, and he'd just been caught and in the camp, and so he wasn't in too bad a condition. I forget exactly, but anyway, he was leading them to get help, and I escorted them to the camp as a hospital this time. And there were 12 or 13 of these people, desperate, kind of corpse-like looking, almost dead people, to the camp. And we cleared a room, or I suppose there was a room spare, myself and one of the medical orderlies. I don't even believe we went to see a doctor or anything. It was an emergency. And got them into the room, got them into bunks, sort of double row bunks. And then I was working on a kind of inspiration that we had these medical supplies. I went to one end of the room and mixed, while they were all watching, well, one or two were unconscious, I think, but, you know, see, watching carefully, I mixed a jug full of very, very weak cocoa or Ovaltine or whatever it was we got out of these supplies, and got mugs and brought each of them a little, but exactly the same amount and very, very weak. And at some point the doctor, we must have, or one of the doctors, I think there were only two there then, we got them down and we made it our job to look after them. One died at once and went on treating them like this. They were Poles and Polish and French, so we were in difficulty with language, a bit of French, and heard about them. Then out of the blue, amongst all this confusion of war, I think it was 3 days later, came three American ambulances. This was most mysterious. You know, they'd come through the Russian lines, in effect, as much as things were fairly fluid. How they knew about these people there, I don't know, but they'd come to fetch them. So there was some radio communication going on somehow, somewhere. And it was incredible. What I suppose were perfectly ordinary Americans, but they looked huge and overfattened, overfed. Kindly men with these three ambulances came in, and I think four or five of them by now could walk. These people that had come in on the cart, but the ones that couldn't, they just lifted them up like babies in their arms into the ambulances and away, back to American lines, I suppose, obviously. But it was most mysterious, this arrival out of the blue. Couldn't have been as quick as that. We must have had conversations and explained what I was doing and all the rest of it. But how they knew, they just came to the door and knew exactly where they were coming. So I suppose, yes, obviously, there was a lot of coming and going of people by some kind of vehicle and some kind of communication. But I was glad. I don't know what happened to those people, whether they survived. I suppose some of them did. So that was the first actual experience of the sight of survivors of concentration camp then.
Were you to see more, Stephen, while you were in Germany?
No. No, not of concentration camp, except the 3 months alongside this Russian prisoner of war camp was as bad in conditions that we were seeing, or nearly as bad, I imagine.
How about the Russians? You were saying about the cyclists coming in. Did you see much more of them?
Yeah, they came into the camp. A medical group came through, and as a matter of fact, took all our operating theatre supplies and tools with them. Instruments.
But they pinched them.
They appropriated them for work elsewhere, I suppose. I mean, I'm just remembering they came through. There was a medical group came through and various other Russians, various friendly groupings came into the camp. One of them gave me some vodka, which I hadn't had any alcohol for a long time, and I mixed it with a lot of water. And I remember being escorted round the village, shouting greetings to everybody I passed. I got very drunk and fell asleep, no doubt. No, it was a perfectly friendly relationship. But one occasion when visiting this family of two women and little kids, I remember one evening late, and I was up with them, I don't know, having some soup or whatever we were doing. And there was a noisy, drunken noise outside. Some Russian soldiers were banging on the front door, and I thought, this is going to be an awkward situation, but they gave up and went away. So that's all I heard of that. Probably they were no more noisy than I was when they'd given me that vodka that time.
Did you hear stories, though, about the way, you know, Russians had behaved?
Not then. No.
While you were in Germany?
Oh, yes, but I put them down as on the same kind of level as things I'd read about 1914 Britain and the Germans eating babies in Belgium and that kind of thing. And I guess, as always, most of that is what it was. The same as now, stories we're hearing about Kuwait, I have a feeling. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what happens.
You never saw anything yourself or heard anything directly?
No. No, I didn't. I'm just trying to think. I don't think I did. Not then.
How long was it before law and order was sort of imposed?
In this village,
sort of,
yes.
Yes,
in this village,
limbo,
yes. It began to be imposed. There was a burgomaster was appointed by the Russian military people in the village. I seem to remember, but we didn't have much to do with that lot, and we went on doing things in the camp as a hospital. I'm just trying to remember this. It couldn't have been many weeks. It seems like a long, long time, but it can't have been very long, because I got back sometime in June.
June 1945?
Yeah, got back to England. We kept getting instructions that came from wherever to stay put, stay put. This was the important instruction. And as a matter of fact, I got appendicitis. Oh, that's why I knew the operating theatre. Instruments had been taken. I developed terrible stomach pain and temperature, and the English doctor came along and said, "You've got appendicitis, mate, and we can't do a thing about it." Tough. So it was really it was. So. But I think it was the next day, or almost at once, that the order was given that we were all to leave and go to Torgau. So everybody in the camp by then, because all the sick had been taken away, except for myself, oddly enough, with appendicitis, and Dennis Westbrook, oddly enough, with jaundice, and one or two others of the camp staff who were unwell. We travelled by horse and cart, not exactly comfortably, is it, rolling around at the bottom, bumping in the bottom, to Torgau, and the others marched there. I think it must have been 20 kilometres, 12 miles. It wasn't too bad a journey. And shoved in a Russian hospital in Torgau, and a large Russian woman doctor came and prodded me, and I was given to understand that we're going to operate the next day. But the next day we were hurled into American trucks, and onto a plane, and back to Belgium, and back to England the next day.